at NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Friday and Dan Hoost is here from Sullivan County Government with news from the county legislature and an update on that upcoming real ID deadline. What do lipstick, bicycles, and homemade bombs have in common? They were all weapons in the fight for freedom. Author Suzanne Cope joins us with the untold stories of fearless female resistance fighters in her book, Women of War. And Books for Kids, Children's Books Book Week is coming to the Western Sullivan Public Library with story times and crafts and movies and engineering challenges. We chat with Callison Stratton about how your family can join the adventure, plus the new exhibit at the Liberty Museum. All that coming up on a Friday, but first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported somewhat stronger job growth in April than forecasters expected. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 320 points in early trading.
Job growth slowed last month, but not as much as analysts had feared as President Trump's worldwide tariffs went into effect. U.S. employers added 177,000 jobs in April. That's down only slightly from the previous month. The unemployment rate held steady at 4.2%, even as more than 500,000 people joined or rejoined the workforce. Jobs were added in healthcare, restaurants, and construction in April, while retailers and factories cut workers last month. The federal government also cut about 9,000 jobs, but that was more than offset by job gains in state and local government. The labor market has held up well in recent months, even as the overall U.S. economy has showed some signs of weakness. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is expected to release a proposed summary of his budget later today. NPR has learned it cuts about $163 billion from discretionary spending that's not related to defense spending. The proposal does not include federal spending on safety nets such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's expected to be shown later in a full budget proposal. The president is removing National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and nominating him instead as U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Waltz admitted he was the one who mistakenly added a journalist to a group chat discussing U.S. military strikes in Yemen. NPR's Franco Ordonez says that close Trump aides didn't fully trust Waltz.
And we've seen Trump lean more heavily on other aides when it comes to big conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza, and even in talks with Iran. Those included Rubio, as well as the Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff, and even Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting. Israel has launched airstrikes near the Syrian presidential palace in Damascus. The bombing follows days of clashes involving fighters from a Syrian religious minority and government security forces. NPR's Jana Raff has details.
The strike before dawn Friday was the second Israeli attack in 2 days in Syria. Israel's defense minister said the latest bombing was a message to the Syrian president that Israel is determined to protect the Druze, a religious minority also present in Israel. And it warned the Syrian government not to deploy its own troops in southern Syria. Israel has launched airstrikes and seized more territory in Syria's southwest since the fall of the Syrian regime last year. The Druze faith is an offshoot of Shia Islam. Clashes between Druze militias, Sunni Arab militants, and government security forces in Druze areas in southwestern Syria have killed dozens of people this week. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up about 400 points. This is NPR. President Trump has signed an executive order targeting federal funding for public broadcasting. It prohibits local public radio and television stations and any other recipients of funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting from using taxpayer dollars. In a statement, the CPB says it is not subject to the president's authority. President Trump accuses NPR and PBS of left-wing political bias. The writer Ksenia Lubrin has won this year's Carol Shields Prize. NPR's Andrew Limbong reports the award honors women and non-binary fiction writers in the U.S. and Canada.
Kinesia Lubrin is a Canadian writer known more for her poetry. Her debut fiction book, Code Noir, won her the prize, though. It's a collection of 59 connected short stories taking inspiration from French King Louis XIV's laws legalizing and regulating slavery in France and the French colonies. Judges for the Carol Shields Prize called it a, quote, virtuoso collection that breaks new ground in short fiction. The Carol Shields Prize for Fiction is relatively new, but it's made an impact on the literary world because of its sheer size. Winners get $150,000. In comparison, winners of the National Book Award receive $10,000. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
The U.S. Geological Survey says there's been an exceptionally powerful earthquake south of the southern tip of Chile. It's in a body of water called the Drake Passage. It also borders Antarctica. The quake's magnitude was 7.5, and there is the possibility of tsunami waves. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. And it's Friday, and we're joined by Mr. Dan Hoost, who's the Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. Happy Friday, Dan.
I've missed you, Tim. Happy Friday to you as well.
I was off last week,
and
yes.
Then I think I was off the week before,
right.
So it's been 3 weeks.
Reunited, so. And it feels so good.
I hope to the audience as well.
Let's talk about the legislature that met yesterday. I want to start off by asking you about the Liberty Police Chief, Steve Degatta, who shared some concerns about the Knights Inn here in Liberty. That's where the county houses some folks on some services. What was the concern from the police chief there?
Chief Degatta spoke during our public safety committee meeting of the legislature yesterday, and you can watch it online. I believe also his comments have been published on social media as well. Basically did a very well articulated, I have to say, just from a language person's point of view, a plea for the county to take more action with the Knights Inn, where we place folks who are in need of emergency shelter. There have been a number of issues that I think your listeners are well familiar with, some that they are not familiar with. Not all of them have occurred with people that the county has placed there, but enough of them have, and there's been enough of a burden placed upon the Liberty Police Department in spending a lot of time there that the chief felt the need to come and address legislators directly. I think they heard him. They listened to him. Exactly what they're going to do about it, that still sort of remains to be determined. I think there's some talk about having the sheriff's office be there more often. Of course, there's still the talk about having a homeless shelter, 20-bed homeless shelter, that might take the pressure a bit off of that. Because the county does not want to be putting people in need of emergency housing into hotels and motels on a standard, consistent basis. But that's been the case for many, many years because there's no other place to put them, especially in such a competitive housing market. So that's one of the reasons the shelter is being considered. However, the shelter is not yet been approved by a supermajority of legislators, which it needs to be. I have been told to anticipate that it'll be a discussion item at this Thursday's Health and Human Services Committee meeting, so you can tune into that. But if they decide to have another vote on it, I believe they're going to have another public hearing on it as well.
Why wasn't it up for a vote yesterday then? Was it just because of the timing of everything and the public hearing that's necessary?
The public hearing happened last month, Thursday, not yesterday.
But then there was a vote, but it wasn't the supermajority vote?
There was not a supermajority vote. There was a majority in favor, but it needed to be 6 in favor, not 5. Mm-hmm. And 5 were in favor. So whether that 6th vote is going to appear is also in question. Not exactly sure whether we'll see that. So it's still very much up in the air. But last I knew from the chair of the legislature, Nadia Reich, and from the chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, Kat Scott, they were very much interested in having an in-depth discussion leading to another public hearing and another vote. But that will be dependent upon their other legislators saying, yeah, okay, we will have a public hearing and another vote. And then, of course, that vote, what will that be? If it's not supermajority, it still doesn't pass.
If this does pass, it will take some time for this to get built. Will that take care of this need, and will that alleviate the concerns that the police chief has at the Knights Inn, for instance? And that's just one place.
Not completely. We have a homeless population, I think currently a little over 100, 120, 130. I'm not sure what the latest numbers are. This is a 20-bed facility for single men and single women, not for families. So, but it might be something that instead of putting folks in the Knights Inn, they might put them in that, because there's really no alternatives. But I still think too, legislators are interested in seeing how they can continue to utilize the Knights Inn for these, needed services, but have it be a place that people can feel safe in, that the local police department isn't coming to the legislature and saying, we need to do something.
All right, let's talk about that real ID deadline. We've been telling folks for over a year that May 7th is the deadline to get that real ID in order to travel domestically. That's coming up Wednesday, folks. So what does that mean if you haven't done it yet?
Well, actually, we should be clear about what the May 7th deadline is. And this is on me as much as anybody else, because I think a lot of people have thought, if I don't get it by May 7th, then I'm out of luck. Real ID will continue to be offered after May 7th. The deadline of May 7th is that if you're planning to fly after May 7th, you are going to have a real ID, or in New York State's case, you could have an enhanced driver's license or a passport just to fly domestically. Forget about the international part of it, which we already knew we needed a passport for. You're going to have it just to fly. Say you want to fly from New York to Chicago. You're going to have either a real ID, an enhanced driver's license, which is basically a real ID with some extra benefits New York State throws in, or a passport. And so I got a real ID. I live in Pennsylvania a few years ago, just because it covers everything for me, except if I'm going international, I'd still need a passport for that. So Russell Reeves, the county clerk, and I put together a fun little video, just under 10 minutes, that aired on our social media a few days ago. It was already gotten, I think, like 10,000 views. A lot of people interested in this.
Is there a dance?
No. Okay. Although sometimes the motions I make, I look at myself like, what were you thinking? But anyway, but it's a way for us to explain as simply as possible what each of these things are. And listen, if you're not planning to fly, if you're not planning to go to Canada or Mexico or any place international, if you're not planning to take a cruise, your standard driver's license, you could stick with that. You don't have to go for anything further.
And you could also wait to go and get this real ID, which you said, of course, will be offered past this deadline on May 7th, because you're also booked through June for appointments, right?
Yes. So if you're looking to fly or travel to Canada, Mexico, or take a cruise sooner than June, still get in touch with our folks. Actually, call the county clerk's office is what I would do, because they work very hard to accommodate people who are in more urgent situations. But if you're not in an urgent situation, you do not need to rush to DMV to get a real ID or an enhanced driver's license. However, if you are looking to travel one of these days outside of the country, or take a flight even inside of the country, it's worth your time to take a look at something, not just the passport, but maybe a driver's license, this real ID or enhanced. We explain all that in the video. I encourage folks to watch it.
And you need an appointment for DMV for this? Walk-ins, yes. Not encouraged?
Walk-ins will try to be helped if we can. We don't like to turn people away, but you could be back to the old days of DMV, waiting hours and hours and hours. The appointment situation means that you're waiting no longer usually than 15 minutes at most, and you'll be seen and helped. This is a complicated process. Sometimes it requires two clerks, one to witness what the other one is doing by law. I think it's the enhanced and real ID that requires that. So we would really appreciate it if you make an appointment. Be aware, though, you don't have to just make an appointment in Monticello. Four of our mobile DMV locations also offer the Real ID or enhanced driver's license sign up. That's Grahamsville, Jeffersonville, Liberty, and I knew I was going to forget the other, Bloomingburg. There we go.
Over 1,300 appointments in April alone for folks at the DMV.
Oh my goodness, yes, they've been busy.
We're talking to Dan Hoost. He's the Sullivan County Government Communications Director. He joins us every Friday with news from Monticello. The county's going to be an interested party in the Town Line Solar Project. That's been proposed for the towns of Thompson, Forestburg area. What's that whole solar project about? And what does it mean if the county's an interested party?
As currently proposed, this project, which would – it's called Town Line Solar because it would straddled the Thompson-Forestburg border near a little community called Melody Lake, sort of just west of the Neversink River Gorge unique area. Largest, to our knowledge, largest solar array that's ever been proposed for Sullivan County. It's, I think, about a 1,200-acre property. And they're looking to do not only a solar throughout there, but also a battery storage facility that would provide, I think it's like backup power to the grid. It's a German multinational company that is interested in, although some local landowners are involved, is my understanding. And they are looking to install this. They are going through, I believe, a state program that allows them, if they so desire, not to have to conform to local zoning and planning. Whether they will do that or not, I don't know, but that's one of the reasons the county wants to sign up to be an interested party. And we're going to be putting out information out there for anyone in the general public who wants to be kept apprised of this too, because it's an enormous project. And while the county has long been a supporter of renewable energy, our planning division also has some concerns about the amount of clear cutting that may have to be involved. Mm-hmm. It's adjacent to the Neversink River Gorge unique area. So there's some questions to be figured out. The county is not taking an adversarial stance at this point against the project. It's taking the stance of we want to be an interested party. We want to be kept abreast on this. And I think the county and the local towns would prefer, too, that we can work together rather than them jumping over any local rules and regulations so that we can make this something that would work for everybody.
The Removing Unsafe Structures program, or RUST, is returning. What is that program about? How does that help remove these structures?
Yeah, this has been a program that has been around for a while, but it sort of disappeared, I think, during or after the pandemic. RUST, standing for Remove Unsafe Structures, $100,000 has been set aside in the current budget from tourism funds that actually the county has gotten, because we've had a lot of money brought in from that, and legislators wanted to start this up again. So did local towns and villages, because what it does, it incentivizes municipalities to remove unsafe and hazardous structures by reimbursing for demolition and disposal expenses. So that basically helps us get rid of blight a little more quickly than otherwise, because if you have a landowner or property owner who's not cooperating or doesn't care or whatever, the towns or villages have to front the money to be able to tear down these structures. That costs a lot for them that they may not have any ability at that moment to really pay for. But if they know that the county is going to reimburse them for that cost, then they're far more likely to do it. So it's a great program, and I'm pleased to see that legislators have said, let's bring it back.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, let's get an update on measles cases. Also, we'll talk about the HEAP cooling benefit program, which is likely to exhaust its funds well before the peak of summer. We'll be back with more from Dan Hoost, Sullivan County Government, after this break. It's Radio Chatskill.
This week on Catskill Character, my guest will be Wayne County director and cinematographer Alexander Hancock. Alex will take us on a road trip out west, starting at Shenandoah National Park and ending on a cattle ranch in Montana. So join Alex and me, Donna Fellenberg, this Saturday. Alex is even going to throw in a trip to Ireland. I'm Catskill Character at 10:30 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, poet and novelist Ocean Wong. He's the author of On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, and now he has a new poetry collection. He'll talk about that and more with filmmaker Mike Mills. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're joined by Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. We've been hearing about measles cases increasing throughout the country. What's going on here in Sullivan County? What can you do with an update? How can you update us here?
Well, thankfully, nothing in terms of measles outbreaks.
Right.
We have not had measles cases that we're aware of in Sullivan County recently, but sources have indicated there have been at least 760 cases across 24 states just this year. So public health is very much closely monitoring the situation, especially in advance of the summer travel season, where we all might spread more things between one another because we're traveling more often. Isn't that fun? Mm-hmm. Measles, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and also the summer camps in the, mm-hmm. in our area mm-hmm. as well. Yep. We'll see an influx of kids coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is required for kids not only to attend school, but to attend those sleepaway camps, not day camps, but sleepaway camps in Sullivan County. So if you want, you can check with your primary care provider regarding titers, which test whether or not your vaccine will still provide immunity and can give you a booster if necessary. So public health is very much encouraging people to stay vigilant about that. And if you haven't gotten vaccinated or you're wondering if your vaccine is still effective, talk to your physician.
And public health advising that everybody's body is different and your resistance to measles could change over time. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the HEAP cooling benefit program. We mentioned that it had launched. Also now hearing it could exhaust its funds before it actually gets really hot out there. What's going on with the funding there?
Yep. Money is tight, as we sort of understand. And while HEAP is the Home Energy Assistance Program is usually thought of as being home heating for the winter, it actually provides a cooling benefit. I know several people who have gotten free air conditioners, and not only the air conditioners free, but the installation as well, and done in an energy efficient manner with energy efficient air conditioners. So if that's something you think you're interested in, even if you don't think you might be eligible, because you probably are, it's a very generous eligibility, you should get in touch with our HEAP office now. Don't wait. The application system, the application process is open now, 807-0142. That's 845-807-0142. They will be happy to guide you through the application process and make sure that if you are eligible for this title to get one, that they will make sure that that happens. If you wait till it gets hot out, there may not be any funds left, and no matter how much we want to help you, we won't be able to because there won't be any funding to provide for that air conditioner.
You were also mentioning that they're closing, the state is closing down its Clean and Tune program, which is, I guess, a tune-up cleaning program that they have.
And they'll even replace your furnace. Yes, it's rather generous with that program as well. I know several people who have
planned to close that next week.
That's going to close down on May 9th. First time in about 15 years that they have closed the program early rather than running it year round. Again, because funds are basically running out. They're tight. And we encourage everyone who hasn't already done so to explore having a Clean and Tune again by calling our HEAP office.
And this is at the state level. It's Albany funding, not the federal level.
Yeah, but we get funding through the federal level, and I think the state is being
reacting,
very cautious mm-hmm. about all of that. Yes.
All right. Let's talk about the first volunteer fair coming up at Cornell Cooperative Extension, Sullivan County here in Liberty. When's that happening? What can folks expect?
Saturday, May 17th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., just down the road from the studios mm-hmm. here at 64 Ferndale Loomis Road. That's Cornell Cooperative Extension's office. This is, I think, was organized and coordinated by county government, but there will be quite a few, I think over 20 different volunteer organizations there looking for people to volunteer with them. And as you well know, I know through the DVAA, we're always looking for volunteers, people who are willing to give of their time with no thought of remuneration other than some appreciation, maybe some hugs and cookies or something, you know, that we could give them. But, as it says on the poster, get involved, make a difference, connect in the community. That's what it's all about, making a difference, meeting new people, and helping something that maybe is close to your heart or you'll find will become close to your heart. Again, that's Saturday, May 17th, between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. I'll be there, so come see me.
And get a hug.
Yeah, I don't know that I'll have cookies, but I can give hugs.
There's a citizens preparedness seminar on May 20th coming up. What is that for? Who's eligible, and why should they think about attending?
This is really cool. Anyone and everyone is eligible, 18 plus. We're not asking for kids to come to this kind of thing, but we do this in conjunction with the New York National Guard. Basically, it prepares you for severe weather events to respond accordingly, recover as quickly as possible. It's a short little course. It'll run just one night, Tuesday, May 20th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at our Emergency Services Training Center, which is near the airport, sort of between Swan Lake and White Lake. And it's really handy. You will get a useful packet out of it, sort of a emergency response kit. It's all free. All we ask is that people register ahead of time. That's at prepare.ny.gov.gov, prepare.ny.gov. You can register for that. Again, it'll be Tuesday, May 20th, 6:30. It'll be a fun time. We might even have a little food there.
Hugs?
Not
advertised.
This is the National Guard. They don't hug.
The Summer Youth Employment Program application deadline's coming up. When's that deadline?
That's coming up May 9th, and we want people to apply, young people to apply. These are summer jobs for ages 14 to 20. This is not 14 to 18 like a lot of people think. This is 14 to 20, and the older ones probably will be given more supervisory duties if they want it. But we have all sorts of different interesting places for youth to go work, and they benefit local organizations who don't have to pay for them. We pay for it. We are asking people, though, to get in touch with our Center for Workforce Development sooner rather than later. Again, we're only a week away from the deadline, and we need to fill up those slots. It is at 845-794-3340. That's 794-3340. That's our Center for Workforce Development. Ask for Krista. She would love to talk to you about the Summer Youth Employment Program, whether you're a teenager or an adult.
And an important reminder that burn ban in New York State remains in effect until May 15th. We saw those wildfires in New Jersey. And want to just remind folks not to burn anything outside.
It looks green. And, of course, we're going to get a lot of rain over the next few days. But it is still very dry out there. There is a reason it goes through May 15th. Please obey the law. It is the law. You can be held legally liable. It might be just a fine, or it might be that you're liable for damage to property and people. Do not burn outdoors. There is no reason for you to do that. You can wait until May 16th to do so.
And before we go, we want to give a special shout out to the Lumberland Fire Department and EMS, recognizing them for rescuing a driver who had been trapped in an overturned car on Route 97.
Yeah, this made the news down in the city even. There was a woman who was driving. I don't know what the circumstances were, but her car went off the road, went down an embankment, overturned, and came to rest upside down, hanging by some trees over a 15-foot ravine. Wow. And if it had gone down farther, who knows what would have happened to her. Thankfully, she was, I think, only minorly injured, and it was incredible effort. The Lumberland Fire Department and EMS led the team, but it was state police, sheriff's office, all sorts of other local fire departments, ambulance corps, and they successfully got her out of a very scary situation. Honestly, I think they do these things almost every day, depending on where you are in the county. And the legislature just wanted to give a shout out to them yesterday to say thank you. We so appreciate the fact that you do this on a volunteer basis.
And thanks to all of the folks in our fire departments and EMS throughout the area. One last mention, too. The Hudson Valley Rivermen basketball team is coming to SUNY Sullivan, and tryouts are being conducted now. Are you trying out?
No. I'm for those who don't know me, I'm 6'4" and a half.
I mean, that's what I'm asking.
And I was my high school's basketball scorekeeper. I would walk into the gym, and all the kids would be like, uh-oh. And then you could hear sometimes the sigh of relief when I stepped behind the scorekeeper's desk and tried to fit my long legs into that thing. So I will not be trying out. But this is a basically like a minor league, amateur league team, the Hudson Valley Rivermen, that is going to be playing at SUNY Sullivan. The county is supporting it through paying for the rental costs for the field house. The tryouts, I think the next one's May 19th at Fallsburg High School, however. That's where the tryouts are going to be held. So you can find more if you Google Hudson Valley Rivermen. But it's really exciting. The legislature wanted me to mention it, that they really support this and hope people turn out to watch the games, even if, like me, you're not going to be trying out.
Dan Hoost, no hoops, just hugs. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
It's great to be back with you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, bringing history out of the shadows and into the spotlight, we'll speak to author Suzanne Cope about her book, Women of War. That's after this break. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Starting in the 1950s, there was a push to get meat onto Americans' plates at every meal.
So you would have breakfast with maybe perhaps sausage offered. You'd have lunch where it would be deli meat sandwiches, and you'd have dinner that would center over a large cut of meat.
The hidden forces behind our everyday decisions. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Joining us now is author and narrative historian Suzanne Cope, whose new book, Women of War, The Italian Assassins, Spies, and Couriers Who Fought the Nazis, uncovers the extraordinary and until now largely untold stories of four courageous women who risked everything to resist fascism in World War II. She'll be in conversation and about her book with writer and reader Tracy Gates on Sunday at Seminary Hill in Calicoon, New York, to talk more about the history, heroism, and real women behind the resistance. Suzanne Cope is also the author of Power Hungry, and her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and more. And she's here now with a preview of that conversation and more about her book. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Tell us first, what drew you to the Italian resistance during World War II, specifically the stories of these remarkable women?
Yeah, well, it turns out my grandmother, she was not one of the resistance members. She was Italian when she, as a child, she lived in Italy, but then she moved to the United States. But it turns out that she is the exact age of these women. And so when I just started doing exploratory work, I had found out about one woman who was part of the resistance as part of another research project. And I was doing more research to see what other stories were out there as I thought about my next book. It just hit me that my grandmother, who was so political and she really taught me about justice, and in a lot of ways she led me towards this work, that she could have been one of them if she had stayed in Italy. And so that made it all the more personal to me.
And let's talk about some of those women, not your grandma, but these other four extraordinary women. Carla Capponi, Bianca Guidetti, Teresa Mattei, and Anita Malavasi. What made you choose these particular women to spotlight?
Yeah, well, I spent a summer a couple years ago, and there were so many amazing stories of women who were doing incredible things. They were delivering bombs. They were supporting and being part of these mountain brigades. They were writing underground newspapers. And so these four women represent kind of the breadth of the different experiences that the women had during the resistance. Of course, there are so many more stories than these. And so I liked that they were from four different places, that they did a variety of things so that we could see what kinds of acts that these amazing women did during the war. And then also, you know, as a historian, I need to have enough information to be able to tell their stories. So they all left behind testimonies or interviews. In two cases, they wrote books. And a couple of them were also married to people that they were partnered with during the war. And so their partners wrote books. So I was able to have all of these different kinds of resources to help really make the stories come alive, because that was really my goal on the page, is to have this be a narrative history, to feel like we were in the moment with them, but to make up absolutely nothing. So everything is true. Everything, even, you know, the emotions that these women felt, those were what they talked about during in their testimonies or on the page. And so it's a completely true story, but it's so evocative. And it was just such a pleasure to research and tell.
And each of them seem to represent a different geography and style of resistance that's also evocative. Is there a favorite story or defining moment from one of their lives that really stayed with you?
Oh my gosh. I know, it's like choosing a favorite child. you know, I do love all of their stories. I think there's a favorite story from each of them. I won't talk about all of them, because you could read the book and read about it. One, I do think that Carla Capone's story in Rome was really wonderful, because I could truly trace her steps all around Rome. I visited Rome multiple times during this research. And so to be able to see some of the places that, you know, that she was spying, to watch the Nazis and the fascists walk around, that was just so powerful, to be able to walk in her footsteps. And I think what she did was incredibly brave. And then, you know, she escaped death a couple times in very close calls. I do have this soft spot for Anita Malavasi, and I spent some wonderful time in Reggio and talking to great archivists there. She was a staffetta, which was a courier around town. So she was delivering bombs and munitions and messages. And then she was almost caught. She was arrested and released and told to come back the next day. And so she knew that she had to escape into the mountains. And so in the mountains, she also realized that the person she was engaged to, that she didn't really love him. And so she broke up with him and she met someone else in the mountains. And so there's this wonderful love story. That's just this one small part of it. And it is somewhat tragic, but I loved being able to go into the mountains, and some of the archivists there have recreated the paths that these women took, like literally up and down ravines where they would go and bring messages and travel between different encampments. And so to be able to walk in those footsteps is really powerful. And I loved getting to know and tell Anita's story a little bit more, because the three other women had more visible lives after the war. Two of them were in government, but she was the one who was pretty well known in her region, but she wasn't as well known around Italy. And so I loved being able to tell her story.
Your book explores not only resistance, but also gender roles, feminist awakening during wartime, challenging traditional expectations. How do you see the legacy of these women resonating with today's movements for gender equality and social justice?
Oh, absolutely. When you think about the world that these women were coming out of, you know, through Mussolini's fascism, he was dictating what people could learn in school. So many, most people did not, these women, but also, you know, many other people their age, they lived pretty much their entire lives under Mussolini's authoritarian rule. And so they didn't really have a greater sense of history beyond what they were allowed to be taught. And so when they began to have this political education, which I think is so important for today for everybody, you know, they saw this larger worldview. And so the fact that these women, especially because women in particular were taught to not be political, not have agency, to be wives, to be mothers. So for these women to really find this agency in this very short amount of time and build a movement, it's hard to think back and be like, wow, they really did this one step at a time. They did not walk into something that was fully created. They created it. And so for me, that's been so powerful and inspirational to think anything we want to do, this is how we begin a movement. We connect with people around us. We learn, we share what we've learned, and we just start to do what we can moving forward. And to see what they created in such a short amount of time is really amazing.
Did writing and researching this book change how you think about activism or resistance or courage?
You know, this book and also my last book, Power Hungry, I was so honored to be able to amplify the stories of these brave people. And it wasn't until somewhat recently when I felt, you know, kind of politically, like, what am I going to do? I feel like I want to do something. Did I, you know, put two and two together and say, okay, self, think about these stories that you've been telling for almost the last decade. You know, what would these women do? What did they do? And so I really, you know, had to, you know, this is what I just said about building something step by step was something that I almost had to remind myself that that was the story that I've told multiple times. And so I really have tried to tell other people, you know, this is where the same people who were building those own movements, this is where they began. And this is where we begin, that we could always learn more, even though, you know, we had a better sense perhaps of history that we've learned in school. I think in a lot of ways we learned a very American focused history, you know, for a lot of reasons. But now the number of people who said, oh, I didn't realize that Italy was under German occupation. I didn't realize the stories of these women during the war. And I thought, yeah, that's right. I didn't know this either until I started doing this research, even though my grandparents were Italian. Mm-hmm. And so to think of all the stories in history we don't know and what we could learn by, you know, learning, reading about this history and informing ourselves and applying it to today, I think is really, really powerful.
Is that what you hope readers, especially young women, take away from Women of War, that awakening?
Certainly, yes. And to think that you could come from, you know, not feeling like you have power. I think that sense of agency is something that struck me with all of these women and so many others whose stories didn't really make the page, is that they, all of them had this particular moment where, you know, they were doing something because it felt like it was the right thing to do, which is definitely a reason to act for sure. And then there was a moment when they realized that their actions had this larger implication and that it could help them reimagine their future. And so what they were doing, yes, it was important at the time and they knew that, but they also were doing something for them and for others like them to help create this future. Because they were fighting against fascism in their own country. They wanted a future where they felt more free, where they had more opportunity. And so once they had that realization, it was like they were all in. And all four of them, they didn't know each other, but they all talked about that same feeling of suddenly they felt power for the first time in their lives. And even though they were doing these actions that, you know, they could have been caught, they could have been arrested or killed at any moment, they still felt that this was the most exciting and important part of their life because this is when they felt that they were making real change.
You'll be in conversation with our contributor Tracy Gates at Seminary Hill in Calicoon, New York on Sunday at 10. You're going to be reading from and discussing the book Women of War, The Italian Assassins, Spies, and Couriers Who Fought the Nazis. There's more information about that event Sunday at seminaryhill.co. More information about author Suzanne Cope at her website, suzannecope.com. Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm a longtime listener. So happy to be on.
Yes, we know that you split your time between Sullivan County and Brooklyn. So thanks for joining us today and hope folks can see you on Sunday.
Great. My pleasure. Bye.
All right. We'll take a break and when we come back, some books for kids. It's Children's Book Week next week at the Western Sullivan Public Library. Callison Stratton is here with more. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
On the next Jazz Night in America, a drummer seeks a larger-than-life sound by unlocking the potential of a double string quartet.
I am kind of incapable of having small ideas.
It's Nate Smith's Kinfolk with members of the Memphis Symphony Orchestra. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Nagin Farsad was all for that new makeup studio at the Pentagon.
I love the idea of like a four-star general showing up at the Pentagon and a PA being like, should I take you to hair and makeup?
Yeah. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll put our best face forward in this week's News Quiz with special guest Natasha Rothwell, survivor of two seasons of The White Lotus. Join us for the News Quiz from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Next week is Children's Book Week at the Western Sullivan Public Library. They're hosting a week full of fun, family-friendly events, from story times and playgroups to movies and design challenges. There's something for every young reader. Joining us today to tell us more is Callison Stratton from the WSPL and also from Radio Catskills, yeah. Liberation Station, Sundays at 7. Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Give us an overview of what Children's Book Week is all about, why it's important for the library and the community.
So Children's Book Week is a sort of nationally celebrated event that libraries and schools and all kinds of civic organizations celebrate across the country. And it's really a time to focus on children's literature and early literacy, an opportunity to get kids excited about books. This year's theme is An Ocean of Stories. Oh. Yeah. But every library, every organization is encouraged to sort of make it their own. So I planned a week full of programs, a bunch of things inspired by children's books. We're doing a lot around Where the Wild Things Are, Maurice Sendak's classic. It's a book that I read my daughter every night, practically.
That phase.
Yeah, oh, very, very much so. All about Max these days.
Well, let's talk about some of the other programs, too. A story time on May 6th and mm-hmm. May 8th. This is for ages 2 to 6. What can families and kids expect during those sessions?
Story time is so much fun. Basically, our kids come in, we do a couple of welcoming songs, we'll do some nursery rhymes, I always bring my guitar and my ukulele and we sing some songs, and we'll read stories, we'll give opportunities for the kids who are developing their early reading skills to identify words and practice some of their reading, and then we will do a craft, an arts and crafts session, something fun for them to work on at the library and inspired by the book, and then they'll get to take it home as a little memento.
And you mentioned Where the Wild Things Are. There's a Wild Things playgroup. So
yes.
What's that going to be about? Kids dressing up as monsters?
Yeah, so that's much more focused on the younger kids. That's like our toddler group for anybody birth to age 3 is sort of our focus for that group. And that's a really well attended group. We meet every week. And so next week, we are going to just have a little bit of a Wild Things theme that'll be in Jeffersonville, and I'm going to give the kids some fun prompts, some songs. We'll shake our sillies out a little bit. We'll do a little bit of reading, so we're just really letting the kids go wild next week, which will be really, really fun, especially because we have a nice big space in the Jeffersonville
room. Are you sure you're not going to allow folks over 3? I mean, I'd like to shake out my sillies.
I mean, if you want to, if you are accompanied by a child.
I want, right. And must really, be this tall.
Exactly. And then later that day, we're keeping the Where the Wild Things Are theme going with movie night.
Yeah. So yeah. What's the movie? Can you give us a hint? And
well, that's the thing.
Oh, it's Where the Wild Things Are?
Yeah. There you go.
There's your hint.
There's your hint. And so that's a really, it's a very heartwarming story and very much an adventure that kids and parents will both be able to enjoy.
Now, this one sounds really interesting. Rosie Revere, the Engineer Design Challenge. That sounds very hands-on and creative. What's the idea behind this and how does it tie into the book?
So that also ties into Children's Book Week, because Rosie Revere Engineer is a book. It's part of a series by Andrea Beatty. And there's all kinds of books, but Rosie Revere is a young girl who is very inspired by the found objects around her and uses the things that she sees to create these extraordinary designs. And so I took inspiration from that book for Children's Book Week. And that's our STEAM Space program that meets every month. And so what we're going to have the kids do is they're going to sort through a bunch of recycled and found objects and build simple machines out of them. And so it'll be a simple machines program. They'll learn about, inclined planes and pulleys and levers. And then they'll also get to design something out of their own imagination.
That's what's great. I mean, it's called Children's Book Week, but in addition to reading, you're encouraging activity and play. How do you see that impacting kids who participate?
Well, I see that as such an important part of early literacy, is not just to see books as, you know, something. I think a lot of kids sort of see reading books as almost like a punishment sometimes. But this is what I always tell parents who are trying to figure out ways to get their kids engaged. I say, find something that's going to spark their excitement and find a way to loop reading into that. So, you know, if a kid loves to dance and play, I'm finding ways to sing songs and do dances that are going to then link up with a book that we're reading, so that they're going to associate that book and the act of reading with the fun activity. And then with the Rosie Revere Challenge, it's a children's book that they can read, they can take home and find inspiration for their own endeavors. And so the kids who are much more inclined towards STEM are going to find a way to see that reading helps them support their excitement for STEM, for science and technology. So I always think that sparking that excitement for reading sort of comes with getting to know each individual kid and finding the things that get them excited.
Yeah, I mean, it really has evolved, I think, over the years, these programs, especially with your input here and how you're approaching it.
Yeah, I think I always kind of go through, go for an interdisciplinary lens with kids, because, you know, one program, you might have a kid who loves art, one kid who loves science, one kid who loves to read. And I always try to find that thing that's going to bring all of those interests together.
All right, let's get the details. How could families register for these events? Are there costs involved?
It is a completely free program. As always, the Western Sullivan Public Library always offers all of its programs for free. People can go to WSPLonline.org and go to our calendar and register. All these events are also, there are links to them on the Radio Catskill community calendar as well. And you can also reach out to me at WSPL.Children's@gmail.com. And if you have any questions about registration or the content of the program, if you think it's right for your kid, you can always just reach out to me directly there.
Do folks need to be a library card holder to participate?
No, they do not. We serve pretty much everybody in our region, and even people who are outside of the Western Sullivan Public Library District, the Sullivan West School District, can get a library card. There's a nominal fee involved if you're out of district. But to attend our programs, you do not need a library card, although we always encourage people to come and get their library cards. Anyone over the age of 5 is eligible for a library card. But anybody is welcome to attend these programs.
Okay, so for families who might be on the fence about attending, my kid doesn't like to read, I don't know about this shaking of silliness, what'd you say? How would you say to encourage them to participate?
Well, I would say that reading and literacy, literacy skills aren't necessarily just about reading. It's about the way that we engage with the world. And every kid has to engage with the world in some way when it comes to words and writing and speaking. It's just a fundamental part of our activity in life and participating in the world. So, these might be a fun way to get your kid excited about reading, even if it's not their favorite thing. And if it is their favorite thing, this is definitely the place for them.
Allison Stratton is the children's programmer for the Western Sullivan Public Library. Mm-hmm. Children's Book Week is next week at the Western Sullivan Public Library branches in Calicoon, Jeffersonville, and Narrowsburg, New York. There's more information at WSPLonline.org. And a program reminder, don't forget Callison Stratton's show, Liberation Station, every Saturday at 7 here on Radio Catskill with female and femme presenting artists. It's your way of getting more representation on the dial, as you say.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Callison.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Time for one more event that's coming up. It is a new exhibit at the Liberty Museum and Arts Center. They're kicking off their season with the second annual Invitational Art Show. It's opening today. Naomi Frumas is the exhibit's curator, and she spoke to our culture reporter, Valerie Manzi.
Good morning, Naomi, and welcome back to Radio Catskill. We have you here today to talk about your second annual Invitational Art Show and an artist talk that's coming up this weekend. The show opens Friday, May 2nd, and there is a reception from 6 to 9, runs on Friday, Saturday, and Sundays through Sunday, June 29th. And we'll also talk about an artist talk that's coming up on Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Liberty Museum in Liberty, New York. So what would you like us to know about this show?
Well, we have six artists, very different styles, but one core thing I would say about each of them is that they each ask the viewer to open up and interact with their paintings. They seek to evoke emotions and go along with their journeys, the artist's journeys. I'll speak first, I guess, for Kathy France especially. She asked us when we hang her painting that we provide a bench, because this painting was inspired by a drive along Route 52. If the viewer sits and spends about 10 minutes looking at it, the colors will come to the viewer and recreate that feeling of driving and the colors.
She also referred to it as driving in the gloaming, which I thought was quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Then we have Marjorie Morrow, who looks out her field at the field of baled hay. And again, that emotion of the land. We have Charles Farless. I look at her, at his plants, flowers. It reminds me of Alice in Wonderland. I can never.
Well, they have sort of a surreal feeling to them.
And we have Frank DeMotica. He has a triptych in particular. He was a drummer, and there's music that comes. It's rhythmic. Now, you mentioned the talk. Lisa Lebowski, she travels all over the world. And she's been to the South Seas, to Antarctica, all the way up to Nova Scotia. She does, in addition, icebergs, oceans. One of her icebergs was featured in the show Severance. That's on Apple TV. And she will feature a different iceberg, but she will be talking. She'll be giving the artist talk on Saturday, and she'll be at the reception. And she'll talk about what it's like to travel, to see these in person, to draw them on plein air, out and outside. So you'll get adventure and technique and just nice. She's a wonderful person. They all are, actually. Like a mother can't pick her own pick a favorite child. I love them all.
Well, we do have so many wonderful artists in our...
It was hard to pick. That's why I have to do one every year. I also have a lady, Irina Chilanova, and she's bringing her works in today. So she'll have to be your mystery woman, okay?
Oh, so she's going to be in the show as well?
She'll be in it, and she does, but that's going to be a mystery. You'll have to come and see her.
Okay, so that's a surprise. So you mentioned that this is, so let's review. The events are coming up this weekend with an opening on Friday, May 2nd from 6 to 9. At Liberty.
There'll be refreshments. You'll mingle. You get to experience it. You speak to the artists. If you're not a member, you may join at the door. You're encouraged to. We appreciate support.
If folks want more information, is there a number or an email address that they can use?
The museum's phone number is 845-807-6055. And... LibertyMuseum.com.
Thank you so much for taking the time to share this information.
Thank you. And we look forward to seeing you there.
And thank you to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that report. Lots going on in the area. You can find out about all the activities and events by checking out our community calendar. It's at WJFFradio.org. While you're there, click on the Protect My Public Media link on the main page to urge Congress to support funding for public media for stations like ours. Yesterday, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to end public funding for National Public Radio and PBS to stop what he called, quote, biased and partisan news coverage. The order directs the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to, quote, cease federal funding for NPR and PBS. The order could be challenged in court. There's still time for you to make your voice heard about how you feel about that. We're asking you to urge your congressional representative to support public media. Go to Protect My Public Media, call your congressman or email your congressman, and show your support for all public media throughout the country, including the one you rely on here, Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Alliances have shifted.
I'm aligned with the United States of America and for the good of the world.
Markets have been sent reeling.
At the moment, we're living through extreme uncertainty.
President Trump has remade relationships with allies and adversaries alike and shaken the global economy. I'm Michelle Martin. Join me for a live special report from NPR News as we look at the first 100 days of the Trump administration and consider what's next.
Monday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather warm with clouds and a thunderstorm in spots this afternoon, a high of 74. Tonight, partly cloudy, mild, low 53. For the weekend, it looks like periods of rain, a shower or thunderstorm tomorrow, and a high of 70, high 64 on Sunday. On Point is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.